army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to Chasing Ghost in Irregular Warfare podcast, episode 80, The Cargo Cult of Martial Belief, Wishcasting, and Bloodshed. So, a little housekeeping is in order here. Things continue to be in flux as we try to complete our move. We have found a house on the Florida Panhandle, a new bunker complex. We will be closing on it in April, so we're still in temporary quarters. I'm recording from temporary quarters and not my customary bunker where I'm most comfortable and have everything set up. So this is something of a slapdash Walter Mitty configuration that I have here trying to record this very episode. And it just so happens that this very episode is my 100th episode since September 2022, when the inaugural episode of Chasing Ghost 001 came out in that month when I had taken the decision to start this. It's a milestone of sorts, and I know you're saying, but Bill, it reads 080 on the episode. Well, that's also because the companion podcast to this, War Notes, it's a conventional podcast inquiry where I wanted to expand my portfolio beyond irregular warfare so that I could discuss new wrinkles, innovations, problems, historical episodes, and things like that. When it came to conventional warfare, unified land operations, naval conflict, that kind of thing. So when one adds that 20 to the 80, one comes up with 100. And here we are at, I would like to take the time to celebrate my 100th episode. Could not have gotten here without listeners, without readers of my occasional dispatches, without those of you who have hung on through thick or thin through 100 episodes of this very peculiar and niche and boutique podcast that will never appeal to millions, but will appeal, I hope, to tens of thousands. So it appears when I look at the analytics for Chasing Ghosts that my total, let's see, my all-time is 209,000 downloads, and last 30 days, 5,400. I don't pay a lot of attention to the metrics and what they mean, nor am I trying to monetize because I'd be lucky to get just a few dollars. This is a project that is both a vanity project and one for which I hope that once I assume room temperature for my friends and family, all of the peculiar thoughts that I usually keep captured inside my head have been released into the microphone, into the ether, and kept for posterity's sake. Will anybody be listening to this 100 years from now? I highly doubt it. But nonetheless, it is a catharsis, a cathartic event for me to be able to speak on these things. So I so appreciate your listenership, your support, and such. If you wish to subscribe, go to my Substack. You can subscribe. If you happen to be on your podcast vendor and you're listening to this, I would so appreciate if you actually starred a review, or better yet, put a narrative review in which you talked about this podcast and whether it is helpful, interesting, or a cure for insomnia. So there it is, 100 episodes, and I could not have possibly done it without your indulgence. So thank you. In other news, my health challenges continue to emerge, but that's probably because I'm getting closer and closer to my expiration date, and there it is. So I will soldier onwards as best I can, and one day, hopefully not soon, when podcast episodes on my fortnightly cadence stop being issued, I suspect I have slipped off this mortal coil to go on to the next adventure, whatever that may be. So as most of you know, my second career is I'm an engineer by trade after retirement from the U.S. Army. And I find increasingly that when it comes to cognitive health, inquiry, Socratic drilling, Ono's five whys, and really rigorous critical thinking just in the military enterprise alone in the West, it is found wanting considerably. And not only is it because of lazy thinking, because of exquisite platforms, and because of so many of the things that I have discussed on both Chasing Ghost and War Notes, that it appears America, and the West by extension, seems to religiously make the same mistakes again and again. As you know, I completed a course for the Scott Horton Academy in which I spoke of the Trail of Tears of Defeat and Stalemate of U.S. Arms since 1945. And then from 2016 to 2020, we had a president who, for the first time in my lifetime, and I'm happy to be corrected, well, actually, since Jimmy Carter, even though one, technically one can say he attempted to get us into a war in 1979 at the failed Iranian rescue attempt. But nonetheless, I was buoyed by the fact that the new administration, in their first term, would find their way and not go to war. Well, it turns out, I think they did that. Well, I had hopes for Trump's third term. So here we are in 2026, and we've got the Iranian business, which I have discussed in detail in a couple of episodes of late. Failure is manifest, the math ain't mathin', and when one looks at salvo competition, which I'll try to surmise here very quickly. Salvo competition, I go into this in great, excruciating detail in other episodes, especially in War Notes. Salvo competition is simply where, let's take missiles, for example, those who have more missiles than the other, because of the curious arithmetic of intercepting said missiles coming in, takes 2 to 4 missiles at minimum to achieve a 90% probability kill against the inbound. When one does this math offensively and defensively, you find that the magazine larders, the kinetic magazines, once they are exhausted, and that's your primary means of interception, you have no means of intercepting any more missiles that are inbound that you have not attrited yet in this war of leakers. America and the West did not do the math correctly when it came to this, thinking that by attacking a country that had been preparing for almost a half century for this very thing to occur, that it would be a short war, a beatdown, a 72-hour fiasco in which Iranians would be laid low, victory would be assented to by America and the West, and everything would be peachy. Well, that's not the way it turned out. It's turning out, nor will it turn out. There's a reason I'm not on the Christmas card list for the Aircraft Carrier Industrial Base Coalition or the irregular warfare institutions in Big Army in the Pentagon and all the services and at the joint level, and I don't get invitations to speak at any of those because I am speaking to things and critical in a way that they cannot countenance. Because in the little bubbles that they live in, SOF in particular, but even we can expand that to Big Army and such, they will not truck with those who have a minority opinion or are rather caustic and skeptical in their views of American military arms around the world. As a lifelong science geek and a practicing engineer and somebody who really digs people like Colonel John Boyd and Dr. Richard Feynman, the physicist, people who press the envelope, people who think critically, people who are on the edges, the wings of that bell curve, who question what's going on. Not only do they question authority, they question obedience to that authority. These are the folks you should listen to. Remember, it was at the turn of the 20th century where all of a sudden the discovery of tectonic plates was such a monumental shift in geological thinking that it resonated and rippled throughout the entire profession for them to rethink what they thought. Or that operations research project in World War II, in which all of these bombers would come back with holes in them, and they wanted to know, well, if the holes are here, and you've probably seen that graphic that shows the B-17 flying fortress with all the holes, but they managed to get back. And then they said, well, what can we do to reinforce? Go to the operations research guys and the mathematicians, and they can tell us what's going on here. But in the end, the primary question was, well, those are the planes that returned. What about the ones that didn't return? That's where the reinforcement mechanisms need to be instituted. We find ourselves there now. Now, one of the primary charters of this podcast has always been, what are the rules of Fight Club? In this case, what are the rules of counterinsurgency? Number one rule of counterinsurgency, don't do it. Well, it appears that when it comes to larger conflicts, conventional conflicts, global conflicts, regional hegemonic conflicts, that especially in this missile age in the 21st century, the discovery is quietly being made that maybe, just maybe, the U.S. isn't prepared. Now, I would tell you that a lot of this goes back to very poor thinking. A lot of this goes back to a lack of critical thinking, a lack of inquiry, a lack of questioning the groupthink that dominates so many of the military complexes in America and the West. And that's a big problem. So I mentioned Feynman. Feynman did a speech in 1974 at Caltech, the graduating class, the commencement address at Caltech, called Cargo Cult Science, and it still resonates with me today, and I hand this out to my students, to my teams and such, because it's so important for us to look at this. I'm not going to read the entirety of the speech. I recommend that not only do you read the speech, but if you can find a way to get a copy of the speech from his actual address in Feynman's own words, I would recommend it. And it's called Some Remarks on Science, Pseudoscience, and Learning How to Not Fool Yourself at this address. Quote, during the Middle Ages, there were all kinds of crazy ideas, such as the piece of rhinoceros horn would increase potency. Another crazy idea of the Middle Ages is these hats we have on today, which is too loose in my case. Then a method was discovered for separating the ideas, which was to try one to see if it worked, and if it didn't work, to eliminate it. This method became organized, of course, into science, and it developed very well so that we are now in the scientific age. It is such a scientific age, in fact, that we have difficulty in understanding how witch doctors could ever have existed when nothing that they proposed ever really worked, or very little of it did. But even today, I meet lots of people who sooner or later get into a conversation about UFOs or astrology or some kind of mysticism, expanded consciousness, new types of awareness, ESP and so forth, and I've concluded that it's not a scientific world. Most people believe so many wonderful things that I decided to investigate why they did. And what has been referred to as my curiosity for investigation has landed me in a difficulty where I found so much junk to talk about that I can't do it in this talk. I'm overwhelmed. First, I started out by investigating various ideas of mysticism and mystic experience. I went into isolation tanks. They're dark and quiet, and you float in Epsom salts, and got many hours of hallucination, so I know something about them. Then I went to Esalen, which is a hotbed of this kind of thought. Remember, this is 1974. It's a wonderful place. You should go visit there. Then I became overwhelmed. I didn't realize how much there was. But then I began to think, what else is there that we believe? And I thought about it, the witch doctors, and how easy it would have been to check on them by noticing that nothing really worked. So I found things that even more people believe, such as that we have knowledge of how to educate. These are big schools of reading methods and mathematics methods and so forth. But if you notice, you'll see the reading scores keep going down or hardly going up again, 1974. in spite of the fact that we continually use these same people to improve the methods. There's a witch doctor remedy that doesn't work. It ought to be looked into. How do they know their method should work? Another example is how to treat criminals. We obviously have made no progress, lots of theory, but no progress, in decreasing the amount of crime by the method that we use to handle criminals. Yet these things are said to be scientific. We study them, and I think ordinary people with common sense ideas are intimidated by this pseudoscience. A teacher who has some good idea of how to teach her children to read is forced by the school system to do it some other way, or is even fooled by the school system into thinking that her method is not necessarily a good one, or a parent of bad boys, after disciplining them in one way or another, feels guilty for the rest of her life because she didn't do the right thing, according to the experts. So we really ought to look into theories that don't work and science that isn't science. End of quote. This is scientism that he is talking about. In my mind, this is anthropogenic global warming. This is what happened during the COVIDiacy crisis, where the entire nation, if not the world, lost their mind to what I do consider indeed a very harmful cargo cult. And of course, the effervescent cargo cult of don't believe your lying eyes, believe what I tell you. So what is this word cargo cult that I keep bandying about? It first appeared in print in November 1945, issue of Pacific Islands Monthly, in an entry written by one Norris Mervyn Bird, quote, stemming directly from religious teaching of equality and its resulting sense of injustice is what is generally known as Vilala madness or cargo cult. A native infected with the disorder states that a great number of ships loaded with cargo had been sent by the ancestor of the native for the benefit of the natives of a particular village or area. But the white man, being very cunning, knows how to intercept these ships and takes the cargo for his own use. We have seen grave harm to the native population arising from this Vilala madness, where livestock have been destroyed and gardens neglected in the expectation of a magic cargo arriving. The natives infected by the madness sank into indolence and apathy regarding common hygiene, with dire effect on the health of the community. End of quote. Peter Worsley, in his 1957 book, The Trumpet Shall Sound, his is a more standard definition of the term. Quote, strange religious movements in the South Pacific that arose during the last few decades. In these movements, a prophet announces the imminence of the end of the world and a cataclysm which will destroy everything. Then the ancestors will return, or God or some other liberating power will appear, bringing all the goods the people desire. In ushering in a reign of eternal bliss, the people therefore preparing themselves for the day by setting up cult organizations or by building storehouses, jetties, and so on to receive the goods, known as cargo in the local pidgin English. Often also they abandon their gardens, kill off their livestock, eat all their food, and throw away their money. End of quote. In 1964, Peter Lawrence goes on to describe it as a cargo belief, described how European goods were invented by a cargo deity, and indicated how men could get them from him via their ancestors by following a cargo prophet or leader. Cargo ritual was any religious activity designed to produce goods in this way and assumed to have been taught to the leader of the cargo cult by the deity. A cargo cult was a complex of ritual activity associated with a particular cargo myth. End of quote. And finally, in 2010, Australian anthropologist Martha McIntyre, oh my God, I loathe anthropologists, she would say the following elements were characteristics. Quote, they involve ritual activities that in some way imitate or mimic actions associated with whites or Europeans. These activities are aimed at affecting transformations or reversals in status, wealth, and power for adherents. They involve stories of loss of skills, goods, and knowledge to white people. They have charismatic local leaders. They have strong nativist elements. They entail beliefs in the return of ancestors bringing wealth in the form of money. They include utopian or millenarian ideas of a future in which people will not have to labor. And they have continued over many decades, changing slightly, but maintaining core beliefs and practices. End of quote. I would suggest to you that one of the largest cargo cults in the history of mankind is Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto. In the 19th century, chattel slavery, that kind of slavery that was neither indentured nor temporary, but chattel slavery, in which not only did you own the slaves that you had, but you owned the children that said slaves would have if they happened to be on your plantation. Because what Marx arrived with in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s was a solution set for the millenarian left, where they could take chattel slavery and develop a system, communism, in which the adherents, the slaves, and the plantation dwellers, the zoo inhabitants, would beg for the cage, the chains, and being told what to do by the state. That, in my mind, is one of the largest cargo cults in existence. But it doesn't mean that this cargo cult behavior doesn't occur in the U.S. military, if not, by extension, those militaries that the U.S. is aligned with. There's a lot of wish-casting going on. Wish-casting is where one would click their red ruby slippers and say, well, it's going to be good, it's going to be great, and I hope that it works. And of course, we know from one former U.S. Army general officer, hope is not a method. So again, Richard Feynman, he uses this term to describe situations where people focus on superficial aspects of a process without understanding the underlying principles. He specifically cautioned against cargo cult science, warning that adopting the appearances of scientific investigation without a self-critical attitude will fail to produce reliable and reproducible results. Now, mind you, in a larger scale, when we look at STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math in the universities, in the 20,000-plus academic journals that are out there that even touch the soft sciences, and maybe even English and such, the fraud, the plagiarism, the lack of reproducibility is just so rampant. Again, I have a plea out to those who have the means to do so. Please, gods, make an AI crawler that goes through all of these electronic journals and starts to query them on that very thing. What is plagiarized without citation? What is reproducible? What is not? What is footnoted and says the exact opposite of what the body of the paper or article indicates that it is actually footnoting, going to the footnotes and seeing where those go? But let us confine ourselves to one of the most interesting aspects today, which is the complete corruption of professional military education in the United States, from boot camp all the way up through the war colleges and everything in between. There is a lot of cargo cult ideas, crazy ideas, fiction that doesn't work in the real world, and a reliance and championing of exquisite platforms that isn't going to hold up in this missile age, in this UAV age, in this age where those very expensive platforms are going to be checkmated by very inexpensive means. For those of you who are perennial listeners, thank you. But I will sound like a broken record. For those of you brand new to this podcast, then you'll hear this for the first time. But it is my assignation that the entire American military complex, from soup to nuts, is a very expensive and very well-performing 20th century peer warfare modality, not fit for purpose in any fashion for 21st century peer combat. And you will rarely hear me use the term near-peer, third world, or developing anymore, because as we've discovered with Yemen, Iran, Syria, Afghanistan, and the rest of them, they have bested, they have defeated, they have stalemated the largest and most sophisticated militaries with a means that does in no way match the budgets or technical capabilities of those larger militaries. If there is a nail in the coffin for the very idea of aircraft carriers, which are the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century, this is it. Iran, albeit I would say Yemen, has proven, for the most part, that they are anachronisms, very expensive. And the worst part of it is not only the unnecessary expense of these weapon systems and platforms that have not seen peer-to-peer fight, for instance, since probably the summer of 1945, and that the air projection, especially with things like the F-35 replacing the F-18 and other such, that our weapon systems, as exquisite as they are, being replaced with inferior weapon systems. You will discover in the next 6 to 12 months, with the return of both carriers from the current scrap in the Middle East with Iran, that it wasn't only laundries and toilets that caused those problems to be there. There may very well be the chance that we'll see the footage of missile strikes on these ships. Have any other U.S. or allied ships suffered missile strikes in the Red Sea or the environs around Yemen and Iran? Well, we're going to wait and see, because it is the habit of the West, unfortunately, to conceal such things. I'm not simply picking on the aircraft carrier. I'm picking on every manned modality that the West uses in all of its military. Manned aircraft, manned tanks, even manned cargo delivery and all sorts of things are all being called into question because of this missile age and this UAV age. The missile age, of course, gives us a salvo competition where you must send a considerable number of missiles aloft to intercept missiles that are inbound, and pretty soon your magazine larder is going to go Winchester and it will be empty. Same thing applies with UAVs, where one can use these $1,000 to $10,000 modalities, and when one uses Patriots and very expensive missiles to take out the UAVs, much less the missiles, in the end, your magazine larders will go Winchester, they will be empty, and then you will feel the full force of the second, third, fourth returning waves of UAVs and missiles that will lay waste to all of these very expensive military platforms and materiel that are on the battlefield at the time. Among the cargo cults that I'm discussing here when it comes to the military, it is from A to Z. It is all the fantasizing and embellishment that goes on in the military education system about the superiority of American arms, which doesn't exist and hasn't existed since 1945. As we speak and record this, there is talk of the Marines or the 82nd Airborne being used for a ground invasion of either an island off the Iranian coast or Iran proper. I would urge all of you, and I did several episodes on this, so I won't bore you with it in this episode, take a look at a map. You will find that 60 to 65% of all of Iran is a mountainous region, and that when it comes to insurgency and counterinsurgency, the insurgents have a direct advantage because of mountains for a variety of reasons. They have that advantage because that terrain is very difficult to put man and machine on. They have the advantage because they know that terrain, and they also have the advantage because, think about this from a mathematical perspective, when you have complex, steep, and mountainous terrain, you are doubling or trebling the amount of land space that has to be secured in an advance to contact or an advance in trying to take tactical and operational objectives, which lead to strategic lodgments, which leads to expansion of said oil spots, and then the advancements from there. It simply doesn't work. And one can find, when you look at Afghanistan, when you look at Iraq, when you look at Syria and all of these, the West does not have a talent for taking ground and retaining ground and expanding said ground. And now we're told to think that in this latest ill-thought-out campaign and conflict against Iran that somehow, some way, despite all of this time since 1945 in failing, that this will be a brilliant strategic win. But then again, we know that always politicians promise us that, well, this will be a short war. This will be a 72-hour war. This will last 1 week. Now, I will give you 1991 with the Persian Gulf War, that it was solved in 96 hours. But nonetheless, this is a fantasy for what's happening right now. I think that generations from now, able historians are going to look back, especially if military history remains alive, since it is being winnowed as both an academic pursuit and a paid position at universities or advocacy tanks, that's what I call think tanks, nationwide, if not worldwide. They're going to look back on this and they're going to try to, through pattern recognition and careful analysis of weapon systems development, for instance, that so much wish casting was going on, so much belting of those ruby slippers and clacking of the bells so that the barking seals in the audience would think, yes, this is a great idea. For the longest time in the Pacific Theater of Operations during World War II, it was the decisive battle that the Japanese wanted to partake in, where they thought that between 1941 and the summer of 1943, they thought that if they could engage the United States in a battle in which it would decisively destroy its cruisers and battleships instead of aircraft carriers, that it would cause the U.S. to come to the negotiating table, maybe negotiate a limited surrender of one kind or another, and to cede to the Japanese all the things that they had achieved in that miracle between November 1941 and May 1942 in their centrifugal strategy near their home islands in the Pacific. Well, that turned out to be wish casting. Same thing occurred with the landing, the last amphibious landing United States forces have done on Incheon in 1950 under the very execrable and awful General Douglas MacArthur, probably one of the most unable captains of U.S. history, if not world military history. But nonetheless, it was a failure because that particular conflict continued not only till 1953, but during part of the conflict, it caused the entire U.S. and Allied forces footprint to shrink to a mere southeastern corner of the Korean Peninsula before they were able to break out of that imposed lodgment. The French lose at Dien Bien Phu in 1954 decisively. In 1958 to 1962, they lose Algeria out of metropolitan France, 1962. They have lost both Indochina and Algeria. Well, then the Americans take on Vietnam, and between 62 and 65, there is much optimism that America, since it had defeated the Axis forces during World War II, that here, a mere generation afterwards, it will be a cakewalk for them to dominate the Vietnamese in this conflict and part ways. Well, they did part ways in 1972 to 1975, in fleeing the country because they weren't able to militarily suborn it. Fast forward to all the other conflicts that have been lost, whether it is Somalia, whether it is Iraq, whether it is Afghanistan, whether it is Syria, whether it is Libya, or other places like Yemen. Again and again, American forces, very high technology. One would consider them not only to be the most expensive, but probably most technologically sophisticated armed forces in the history of mankind, defeated, stalemated, time and time again. This Iran adventure will be no different from that. So enough of that. I think that I'd suggest that I stop my complaining and offer some solution sets here. Now, these solution sets are not so much tactical and operational, but strategic and grand strategic. And it is the reason why I don't get invited to cocktail parties in Mordor on the Potomac, because from neither party do we have anyone who doesn't suffer from not only strategic deficit disorder, but the willingness to face up to the fact that with this new age in the 21st century of warfare, America, for the most part, is not fit for purpose to fight against its foes planet-wide. So here are some suggestions. I have a host of suggestions, but because I am limited on time, I can't really proffer all of them. So I'll proffer some of the ones that I think are more important, and I'll focus first and foremost on a strategic realignment that is needed for the United States and its Western allies as we speak, but precisely for the United States. It is time for it to take a knee, rhetorically, and consider that maybe the Monroe Doctrine wasn't so bad. If there is a need to have a hegemonic spread for the United States, why not confine it to the Northern Hemisphere? Why not create a Monroe Doctrine that is revitalized and focuses on this hemisphere? And then America could do something that it hasn't done for decades, generations, if not a longer period of time than that. And that's actually defend the homeland, which the Pentagon doesn't do, nor does the Department of Homeland Security, as is evidenced by the fact that America doesn't have the missile strength, and I have covered this in other episodes, to defend itself from singletons, duos, or even a handful of incoming, especially hypervelocity, missiles with either nuclear or conventional warheads that would not land in our laps in the United States proper, whether that is CONUS, Alaska, Hawaii, or our friends to the north and south. So what's to be done? What's to be done is that we close bases overseas. Now, when it comes to base alignment and closures, or base realignment and closures, BRAC, which was a process that was instituted years ago. As a matter of fact, there were 350 installations that were closed in five BRAC rounds from 88, 91, 93, 95, and 2005. These five BRAC rounds constituted a savings of tens of billions annually. A little bit of background here. The Federal Property and Administrative Services Act of 1949 passed after the reorganization of the national military establishment, had a number of successful closures of bases. It was Kennedy in 61 who ordered the closure of 73. In 1964, McNamara announced the closure of 26 DOD installations within CONUS. 65, they announced 95 base closures and realignments, 80 of which were in the United States alone. 68, in Project 693, established by Defense Secretary Clark Clifford, who would succeed the infamous McNamara, also closed several installations. In 69, 307 bases began to be closed. In 1973, 224 closures were announced. In 1974, in Project Concise, eliminated most of the Project Nike missile locations, which each had two sites. 1983, for those of us old enough to remember the Grace Commission, which was part of Reagan's private sector survey, also closed things, along with the 1988 Carlucci Commission. And on May 3rd, 1988, the Carlucci Commission was chartered by Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci, and they closed five Air Force bases to include Pease, Norton, Mather, George, and Chinook. So what I'm proposing here when it comes to closing bases and such is nothing new and can certainly happen. Allegedly, there are hundreds of installations overseas. What one could do is start closing those, start bringing everybody home, and start concentrating on a revitalized Monroe Doctrine, which would either furlough or cashier the troops when they come home if they happen to be excess, or consolidate them into a number of bases in the United States. That would be a way for fiscal sobriety to start to insinuate itself at last in the Pentagon and the DOD. Which brings us to another point, and that would be Greenland. Greenland has been much in the news in the last 18 months. Now, whether you are a partisan of the present administration or not, for the longest time, since 2016, as a matter of fact, the administration has insisted that NATO was not shouldering their fair share of expenses. And they pressed them and pressed them to meet 2, 3, 4, 5% of their respective GDPs, which would be devoted to defense expenditures and such. Most of them were slow to roll off of that, excepting Poland. Then all of a sudden, I suppose, someone in the administration said, why don't we use Greenland, a territory of Denmark, as it were, as a point of contention, almost harmless, at which one could prod, whether this was done through clandestine means or public embarrassment, to increase the amount of money that they would expend for their defense expenditures. To me, on the whole, it looks as if it did that very thing. But I think one thing that has not gained Americans' attention is the fact that when it comes to Greenland, America doesn't have to invade or do anything like that. For the longest time, especially during the Cold War, America maintained a number of bases all along Greenland and did not need to get NATO permission to do so. If you would take the time to look at the 1951 Defense Agreement, which established U.S. rights to operate defense areas in Greenland, it focused on Arctic defense against what was then the Soviet threat. Now it would be the Russian threat. The 2004 amendments, this would be the Igaliku Agreement, updated the 51 Treaty to allow for Thule radar upgrades, missile defense integration, and to strengthen local cooperation with Greenland's home rule government. You will note that those agreements were also when Russia was starting its military ascendancy. Now, there's a NATO-SOFA, a Status of Forces Agreement, that governs the legal status, rights, and responsibilities of U.S. military personnel and contractors stationed in Greenland. And in the updated cooperation that just came to light in 23 and 24, in light of this increased Arctic competition, because it just so happens that the Russians have 55% of the entire radii of the Arctic, surrounded and inhabited not only by military bases and personnel who are habituated to the very harsh conditions there, but they happen to have been there for generations. And those discussions have led to an even broader agreement, whether NATO likes it or not, in which America can put almost an unlimited number of forces or installations on Greenland proper and not even have to get a veto from NATO. And if NATO were to do so, it would have no power of law in international relations. So it turns out that Greenland does not have to be invaded. Greenland can simply be augmented by U.S. forces. And the reason I bring that up is because in my concern with the Monroe Doctrine, I do think that Greenland is part of that. Because Greenland would shield a lot of missile travel from Russia, from China, and even from what I like to cunningly term the EUSSR, this emerging Brussels blob and NATO force that has started saber-rattling even against its largest defense contributor, the United States. Because I would consider this to be a possible shield for homeland defense for the United States against said missile barrages, to include IRBMs, ICBMs, and such, where one would be able to extend the length and depth, as it were, of said defense if those batteries, those defensive batteries, were located in Greenland instead of the eastern United States. Speaking of the Arctic, I would also try to find some way either to lease or contract with competent companies to build icebreakers for the United States. Medium, large, ultra-large icebreakers. The Russians literally have hundreds in their fleet, and it just so happens that America has 1.5. You heard that right, ladies and gentlemen. 1.5, because one is being cannibalized to keep the other one afloat in the United States Coast Guard. And I do think that there's a necessity for that, but then again, shipbuilding throughput in America is probably at an all-time nadir. And by the way, that would include a complete withdrawal from bases all around the planet, starting with all bases in the Middle East and starting with all bases in NATO. One could make the announcement or declaration that all U.S. forces would be departing said bases in 30 days. Whatever remained after 30 days would be blown in place so that it would be militarily unusable by the nation state it just so happened to be residing in at the time. America should withdraw from NATO entirely and even from CETO entirely. As a matter of fact, I would recommend that the United States share nuclear weapons technology with both Taiwan and Japan. Next would be a missile defense dome for CONUS, maybe for Alaska, maybe for Hawaii if America decided to keep it because they really don't even want us there. It is absolutely imperative that America start defending its own. After all, it was the Department of Defense, and they changed it to the Department of War, and it just so happens that war is a far more accurate marker of what it does than defense, because the DOD doesn't do defense. By the way, per the defense of the homeland and the United States, it is high time. Again, shipbuilding throughput would be a problem here, and the creation of an entirely new labor pool and skill set when it comes to diesel-electric submarines. But when one looks at the advances that have been made with diesel-electrics with either the Germans or the Japanese, there are plenty of diesel-electric submarine hulls out there that the U.S. Navy could simply copy or contract for being built and make those replace the littoral combat ship fiasco that has seen almost 50 ships approved in the early 2000s and the retirement of these worthless hulls, sometimes 5 years into their fielding as commissioned hulls in the U.S. Navy. All along, this was the littoral combat ship, not the piece of garbage that is presently floating about around as curious dumpsters that are afloat, but diesel electric submarines. We have none. All we have is a nuclear submarine force. We have an incredibly viable nuclear submarine force. As a matter of fact, I would suggest that America has the best nuclear submarines on Earth, and with the submarine launched ballistic missile, it is probably identifiably the most crucial of the triad of nuclear deterrent weapons that the United States possesses, and I would also call for the retirement of all land-based, silo-based Minuteman, soon to be replaced by the Sentinel, ICBMs that are currently in the arsenal, and the retirement of all the Whiskey 61 and cruise missile nuclear weapons that are launched off of the B-52 or the B-1. Even so, the B-2, which I think has a fleet of approximately 20, is to be either augmented or replaced by the Northrop Grumman B-21 Raider, which is the next generation, sixth generation stealth bomber. By the way, I've covered this in detail in other episodes. The term stealth is very expensive, it's bandied about, but any nation that has long-wave radar can find ways to detect stealth aircraft that are inbound, not to mention monitoring airfields that happen to host stealth aircraft to do some notebook or napkin calculations as to where they may be headed once they launch. They claim that B-21 will have a price tag of $700 million per aircraft. I am not a supporter of manned aircraft. I am not a supporter of manned tanks. I think it is time for even manned surface vessels to go the way of the dodo. As a matter of fact, it is time for the U.S. Navy to reconsider entirely its fleet configuration and order of battle to eventually phase out surface ships. Now, I know this sounds astonishing and maybe even fantastical to talk about that, but it appears, especially if one were to go against the Chinese in the Pacific, the far Pacific, littoral to their own shores and their second and third island chains, there is no surface ship that is going to survive there in a war of leakers in the missile barrages that will come upon those ships if they were to get within range of the Chinese mainland. And last but not least, even though there's a host of other recommendations I can make, but for the sake of the brevity of this podcast and trying to keep it under the time that I usually keep them at, we're going to confine ourselves to this present list. And that's this, Trail of Tears, the course that I did for the Scott Horton Academy, where I talked about the defeats and stalemates that have been consistent since the end of 1945 for U.S. arms and forces abroad, continues in a sterling track record of stalemate and defeat. And part of this happens to be professional military education. I'm talking about the service academies from West Point to the Air Force Academy to Annapolis and all the rest. I'm talking about the ROTC programs. I'm talking about boot camp. I'm talking about the initial officer ingestion programs for training officers such as the Marine Corps with the basic school, all the way through CGSC for the U.S. Army in Kansas, all the way up to the war colleges and everything in between. This entire rotten framework is absolutely inundated and termite-ridden with woke madness, with sham military formulae, with an almost imbecilic disregard for military history and what works and what doesn't. In the prism of this education process, these are the places where even advocacy tanks come out of, who are talking about or writing about or issuing white papers on the very best way to buy the very best next weapon system to use in a fashion with the tactics, techniques, and procedures that are adopted at the time to defeat the latest phantasmagorical enemy. Well, I'm here to tell you it doesn't work. For instance, I would tell you that the defense academies, West Point, Annapolis, all the rest I described, need to be closed immediately. They need to matriculate every student who is in those academies into an ROTC program at a non-Ivy League institution. I say non-Ivy League because all ROTCs at Ivy League universities need to be disbanded tomorrow morning. They need to be destroyed in place and the earth salted because that woke mind virus has absolutely infested the United States military, and I'm not blaming it as the primary cause, but I would say it is a proximate cause of global military stalemate and defeat for the United States. Look, a lot of this is going to be hard to swallow. I am telling you this as a retired officer of the United States Army. I'm telling you this as someone who participated in PME as an irregular warfare senior advisor, teaching officers at a defense installation for years. This is a critical, fundamental problem that needs to be addressed, and it isn't. These people need to be rooted out, they need to be fired, and at last, at long last, in this list, we need to hold flag officers and senior executive service termites accountable for the harm that they have done, not only to the structure, to the acquisition, to the adoption of exquisite systems and platforms that don't work, but the sheer existential martial malpractice that they have visited upon every military effort that the United States has partaken in since 1945. This is a crisis, and it is not addressed. Our military is being run by cargo cultists who don't know how to fight in 21st century peer conflict. So that concludes this effervescent and cheery episode of Chasing Ghosts. Once again, this just so happens with the combination of War Notes podcast the 100th episode between War Notes and Chasing Ghosts. I will probably pop the bubbly in the actual 100th episode of Chasing Ghost to share my delight in longevity and actually keeping this thing going on a fortnightly basis. Thanks for listening. And if you get the opportunity on your podcast vendor of choice, whom you may be listening to my voice on, if you would be so kind as to leave a 4 or 5 star review, or better yet, a narrative review, and a reminder for those of you who are paid subscribers, not only will you receive these missives, these broadcasts earlier than the general public, but you will also have access to a chat with me on Substack, a Signal chat, and an email to write me to, because you guys are first among equals when it comes to responses from me. For both my paid subscribers and everybody else, please, I would urge you to go to my Substack. I have a comment section below every one of these podcast episodes and would love to engage in gentlemanly conversation with you. If you think that I'm just full of it, or I don't have the greatest of ideas, or you want further explication of some of the things that I'm talking about, love to have that conversation with you, because through that prismatic examination of these things, maybe, just maybe, we can save what is left and right this ship. I'm a bit pessimistic now, but we'll see what we can do. And also, on a more minor note, those of you who are perennial listeners know that I have had a couple of health events that happened to coincide with this move. And in one of those health events, I suspect I had a mini stroke, which has affected my articulation and elocution. So please be assured, I have not been drinking while I've been recording this. And on occasion, my words may not come out as clearly as they would otherwise. And I remind you, I stopped drinking last August in 2025. So here it is, there it is, and I'm getting better and better every day, as Chief Inspector Dreyfus would tell Inspector Clouseau. And thanks again for listening. This is Bill, out.